You're tuned into Broadcasting History, the HBCU Radio Legacy. I'm your host, Fran Robinson. For decades, radio has carried the voices, music, and stories of our communities across cities, states, and generations. Today, we're exploring the vital work of radio preservation, with a special focus on HBCU Radio's rich legacy in America. Joining me on this journey is Miles Johnson. Miles, welcome to the show.
Fran, thank you for having me, and it is truly an honor to be here.
Miles, before we dive in today, I'd like to hear about your personal connection to HBCU Radio.
Yes, well, HBCUs run deep in my family. My dad went to Morehouse, and my mom went to Spelman, class of 96. Once I got to Morehouse, I ended up getting involved in the school newspaper, the Maroon Tiger. And so HBCU Radio is so important to me because just like the Maroon Tiger, and recognizing its history and recognizing the greats that came before me, I definitely want to do my part in amplifying those voices.
HBCU Radio was a platform I was introduced to while working at Central State University in Ohio. It was a hub for independent programming, ideas, and formats. And most importantly, I think HBCU Radio on campuses across the country, I think they're training grounds for so many students. But before we explore the world of HBCU Radio, let's establish some context for our listeners. Radio in America has a complex history dating back to the 1920s.
Absolutely. By the mid-1920s, radio was revolutionizing American life. Commercial broadcasting was taking off with stations like KDKA in Pittsburgh and WEAF in New York. But we should note that the radio presented a dichotomy for Black Americans.
Henry, this young tooth is about to kill me. I ain't never had a toothache like this before.
Well, here's the dentist's office. Let's open the door and get on in there.
Come on in there with me now, Henry. Stick with me now.
Take off your hat now. Take off your hat.
Let's hear from Dr. Bala Baptiste, professor of mass communications at Miles College, who explains how early radio portrayed Black Americans.
It started with us not being taken seriously, joking and laughing and singing and slapsticking. And white people wanted to present Black people as though they need not be taken seriously by any respectable white person. So we were presented in rather stereotypical ways. And
when I was a little boy, how is that, Henry?
Keep on, don't turn around.
Accursed as I is to making speeches.
You is crazy.
Accursed as I is to making speeches, you is crazy.
Dr. Baptiste is absolutely right. These stereotypical portrayals were harmful, but eventually Black voices began finding their way to the airwaves. By the 1940s, stations began recognizing the commercial potential of Black audiences. WDIA in Memphis made history in 1948 when it switched to an all-Black programming, though it wasn't Black-owned. A year later, Jesse B. Blayton Sr. purchased WERD in Atlanta, making it the first Black-owned radio station in the United States.
Good morning, Atlanta. We're here.
Well, it's 12 noon and it's time. What's fascinating about radio history is how it functions as both a tool for oppression and resistance simultaneously. Miles, can you talk about the risk involved when stations transgressed the expected norms?
The consequences could be severe. During the Civil Rights Movement, stations that broadcast information about demonstrations or interviews with movement leaders faced license challenges, economic pressure, and sometimes violent intimidation. Black radio stations walked a particularly difficult line. They needed to maintain their licenses while serving communities hungry for authentic representation and information.
Now let's talk about access and control. The FCC licensing history regarding Black ownership tells quite a story.
It does. For decades, Black ownership of radio stations was extremely rare. the FCC's policies, while not explicitly discriminatory on paper, created enormous barriers through capital requirements and technical specifications that effectively excluded most Black applicants.
Dr. Baptiste explains how radio ownership and content were controlled differently across regions.
In the South, it was whatever was the acceptable standard way of dealing with Blacks coping with the environment, with the political, social environment. The established Black leadership, the middle of the rollers, the let's turn up the cheek, the slow progression, the not disrupt very much, let's be nonviolent. That was the talk for the most part in the South. But in the North, it was a lot different. Pretty much, not everywhere, but in Chicago, certainly hugely different. There was progressive talk. I call it progressive, in that there was talk of Black nationalism, Black separatism, Black power, Black economic self-development.
And he points out an important factor about ownership that still resonates today.
The ownership was important too. I saw a relationship between owners who were conscious about suffering. Like, for example, WVON in Chicago was owned by Jewish brothers, the Chess Brothers. They understood they were poor in their upbringing. They became wealthy, but they were poor in their upbringing, and they understood discrimination against Jews and being an outcast, and so forth. And so they were amenable to the attempts of the Black announcers and blessed announcers with they were meaningful to their discussion about how to being honest about racism and what needs to be done to minimize the damage and minimize the effects.
Another first for WVON, a two-sided hit record, and you hear both sides on WVON.
The late 1960s marked a huge moment for Black radio. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 created new funding opportunities that helped diversify the airways. Programs like Night Call with Del Shields created national call-in forums where Black listeners could directly discuss social issues affecting their communities.
This is Night Call, nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight, Vietnam. Are the peace talks for real? With guest, author, and professor...
The music was transformative too, wasn't it?
Definitely. DJs like Frankie Crocker in New York, Herb Kent in Chicago, and Tom Joyner built massive audiences and wielded significant cultural influence. They created community gathering spaces on the air. Radio was the internet of its day for Black America.
107.5 WVLS at 60 degrees in the city. Clear.
And beyond entertainment, Black radio served crucial informational roles.
Critically important roles during natural disasters, civic emergencies, and political upheavals, Black radio stations often provide the only reliable information tailored to their communities. During the 1967 Detroit uprising, Martha Jean, the Queen Steinberg at WCHB, used her show to urge calm while still addressing legitimate grievances that sparked the unrest.
Which brings us to the urgent question of preservation. Why does preserving radio matter so fundamentally?
Dr. Josh Shepard, Associate Professor of Radio Studies at the University of Colorado and Director of the Library of Congress Radio Preservation Task Force, explains the immense historical value hidden in these archives.
People think of radio and most media as entertainment. But it actually turned out to be more like documentary evidence of call-in shows, talk shows, journalism. And then we realized it was actually probably the largest collection of alterity experience and alterity voice that's unfiltered by gatekeeping functions, probably of anywhere. And this really mobilized and galvanized a lot of scholars who I think were waiting to work in recognition projects that would address deficiencies in the record for equality of voice.
The Radio Preservation Task Force has been doing incredible work to catalog and preserve these at-risk collections. The alterity or perception of difference from the dominant narrative represented in these archives gives voice to communities historically pushed to the margins. Dr. Shepherd shares the scale of what's really at stake.
By the end of the third year and two conferences on Capitol Hill at the Library of Congress, it had become clear that it was actually the largest unexplored and unpreserved medium, not only in the country, but in the world probably, with maybe a million hours of unpreserved content.
That's why this work is so urgent. These materials, in lieu of archives, contain irreplaceable historic documentation, including interviews with civil rights leaders, coverage of local movements that never made national news, cultural programming that preserved oral traditions, and musical innovations. When these recordings degrade or disappear, we lose the crucial chapters of American history. We've seen challenges in this work, haven't we, Fran?
Unfortunately, yes. Many archives have faced limited funding that forced difficult choices, and the technical expertise required for proper audio preservation isn't always available at smaller institutions. Dr. Shepherd highlights the economic reality of preservation at work.
So let's take public media, for example. They've been given $2 million total in the history of the country by Congress to preserve essentially a federal agency. And most of that, if not all of it, went to the American Archives Project on that. But there's been none since. I think we're looking at 14, 15 years now since that money was even remitted. So what we have then are, and I've had the fortune to work with all of these institutions multiple times, is you have the CLIR, the CLIR people, who are Mellon connected, who are doing amazing work helping to preserve what they call hidden collections. So that's a little bit of money per year. It's usually between $3 and $5 million, I think, per year total. And then you have NEH, National Endowment of the Humanities, who are potentially under duress right now with the new administration. And you're looking at probably $1 to $2 million total coming this way in the best years from what I've seen. And it was zero before the task force. So what are we looking at? We're looking at maximum $2 to $3 million per year to preserve collections. Each collection based upon curation of within the collection. So you can only preserve so much, right? You're looking at $200,000 to $300,000 per collection. And it's usually only a fragment of the collection.
These numbers reveal a stark reality about what we value as a society. When we underfund preservation, we're making choices about what stories survive.
That brings us to the heart of why this matters beyond just dollars and cents. Dr. Baptiste reminds us why this preservation work is fundamentally about the truth.
Truth. We will lose truth. Our stories will be mistold if they're told at all. Just in passing, a few liberal whites are going to say a few things. So those are, the truth is at the core, or at the heart, at the center target of it.
Truth. When we preserve Black radio, we're ensuring that future generations understand the full richness of Black intellectual and cultural life, the strategies of resistance and community building, and the vital role these institutions played in shaping American media and society.
Beautifully put. Coming up after the break, we'll explore a particularly vital chapter in this story, the one that we will be focused on throughout the remainder of this series, the remarkable legacy of radio stations at historically Black colleges and universities. We'll be joined by our special guest correspondent, who will take us through this fascinating history. You won't want to miss it. Stay tuned to Broadcasting History, the HBCU Radio Legacy.
Broadcasting History, preserving the voices of yesterday, today.
Welcome back to Broadcasting History. Now we're turning to the establishment and impact of radio stations at historically Black colleges and universities. To guide us through this history, we're joined by our special guest correspondent, Olivia Green. Olivia, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Fran. The story of HBCU radio stations is one driven by innovation, determination, and powered by cultural preservation against significant odds. While commercial radio began flourishing in the 1920s, HBCUs wouldn't establish their own stations until after World War II. The pioneering HBCU stations emerged in a period where segregation still dominated American life, creating crucial platforms for Black voices, music, and perspectives. Central State University in Ohio was among the early HBCUs to establish campus radio operations when WCSU began broadcasting in the early 60s. Several other pioneering HBCU radio stations soon followed, including WHOV at Hampton Institute, now Hampton University, which received its FCC license in 1964 after operating via carrier current since the 1940s. This tradition of HBCU radio excellence continued with stations like WANM at Florida A&M University and KTSU at Texas Southern University, providing important platforms for student voices and community engagement. These young stations, often powered by ambitious students and impassioned faculty, faced enormous challenges. First, there were the technical and financial hurdles. The FCC's licensing requirements demanded substantial capital investment and technical expertise. Many HBCUs operated on shoestring budgets, and so establishing a radio station required not just a transmitter and expensive studio equipment, but also trained personnel. Second, HBCU stations had to carefully navigate the racial politics of their era. In the South particularly, these stations operated in communities where white power structures viewed Black self-expression with suspicion or outright hostility. Although these obstacles persisted, by the 1970s, dozens of HBCUs had established radio stations. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 provided crucial funding that helped many institutions upgrade their facilities or establish new stations. This legislation, alongside the broader civil rights movement, created openings for Black institutions to claim space on the airwaves. From the beginning, HBCU radio stations weren't just thinking about playing good music. They served multiple missions. They were educational spaces where students and community members gained hands-on experience in broadcasting, journalism, and media production. These stations trained generations of Black media professionals who would go on to careers in commercial radio, television, and later, digital media. They were cultural archives, preserving and showcasing Black musical traditions from gospel and jazz to R&B and hip-hop. Many musical innovations found their first airplay on HBCU stations before crossing over to mainstream audiences. Take Texas Southern University's KTSU. They were the first station to play hip-hop in Houston. Last, these stations were community lifelines, providing vital information during crises, coverage of local events ignored by mainstream media, and platforms for discussion of issues affecting Black communities. This kind of programming reflected each station's unique position at the intersection of education, culture, and community service. And unlike commercial stations driven primarily by advertising revenue, HBCU stations could experiment with formats and content. Morgan State University's WEAA became known for its jazz programming at a time where the genre was disappearing from commercial radio. Texas Southern University's KTSU developed a solutions journalism community affairs show that addressed local concerns while training student reporters. The 1980s and 90s brought both challenges and new opportunities. Technological advances reduced the cost of broadcasting equipment, allowing some HBCU stations to upgrade their facilities, but Reagan-era deregulation of the radio industry led to increased consolidation, making it harder for smaller stations to compete. Today's HBCU radio stations face a rapidly changing media landscape. Digital streaming, podcasting, and social media have transformed how audiences consume audio content. Many HBCU stations have adapted by developing online platforms, mobile apps, and on-demand content, all while maintaining their traditional broadcasts. Stations like WCLK at Clark Atlanta University and WEAA at Morgan State University now reach global audiences online while continuing to serve their local communities. This digital evolution has preserved the essential role of HBCU radio as a cultural repository and community resource while expanding its reach. The significance of HBCU radio extends far beyond their campuses. These stations preserve the traditions that might have otherwise been lost. They documented local activities often ignored by mainstream media and provided crucial platforms for Black thought leaders and artists. As we look at the legacy of HBCU radio, we see an extraordinary achievement. Educational institutions with limited resources created broadcasting operations that not only trained students, but transformed American culture. Back to you, Fran.
Thank you, Olivia, for that history of HBCU radio.
We'll be right back with more broadcasting history, the HBCU radio legacy.
Welcome back to Broadcasting History. Throughout our show today, we've explored the rich history of Black radio in America and the specific legacy of HBCU radio stations. But as we've touched on, this vital history is at risk of being lost forever due to deteriorating recordings, obsolete formats, and limited preservation resources.
That's right, Fran, and that's where the HBCU Radio Preservation Project comes in. This project is an ambitious initiative dedicated to safeguarding this irreplaceable audio legacy. The project represents the most comprehensive effort to date to identify, digitize, and preserve the audio archives of HBCU radio stations nationwide, as well as engage in training oral history and community engagement.
Miles, it's amazing how this project has grown from an idea into a nationwide preservation effort. And we're fortunate today to have with us the visionary and founder behind this initiative, Jocelyn Robinson. Jocelyn is a media producer, educator, and preservationist who recognized the urgent need to start this project. Jocelyn, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm really happy to be here, Fran. Thanks for having me.
Jocelyn, what inspired you to start the HBCU Radio Preservation Project?
It's a long story, but I can honestly say that the Black voices in the archival collection at WYSO Public Radio in Yellow Springs was a major inspiration. WYSO started out as the student radio station for Antioch College, and in the 60s and 70s in particular, there were so many important voices of the day represented in their collection. Voices like that of Alice Walker, Gwendolyn Brooks, Kwame Ture, Ralph David Abernathy, Florence Kennedy, even the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s voice is represented in the collection. And there were many others. Back in the day, folks would come to visit campuses and they were recorded by the radio station, like on the college lecture tour circuit sort of thing. And so Antioch just has this phenomenal collection. And I started working with this material when I took WYSO's Community Voices production course back in 2013. And I used some of the historical audio, some of that material in my final piece. And I have to say, I was bitten. I was bitten by the bug. And as a producer at WYSO, I worked on a series called Rediscovered Radio, and I got to dive into the collection and make dozens of short documentaries using much of the material, along with some contemporary interviews. And as I got more into radio preservation, I became curious about what voices might be found in the archives at the radio stations at our historically Black colleges and universities. And so I decided to find out.
Ms. Jocelyn, it's a pleasure to be here speaking with you right now. I wanted to touch on networking and the relationships that you built in this journey. So how did you build the initial relationships with the HBCU radio stations in the project?
I started out virtually. I sent out a lot of emails. With modest support from the National Recording Preservation Foundation, I designed and administered a survey on the radio stations to find out what kinds of materials they might have, what its condition might be, and what kinds of preservation needs they might have. And I followed that up with some site visits to about a third of the stations that I'd identified and slowly began to develop relationships with the station managers and with the archivists at the campus libraries. Because in many cases, those folks had never spoken, folks on campus that had never really spoken. The archives didn't routinely collect the radio station's materials. So I got to spread the gospel of radio preservation at the time. It was a really interesting opportunity. But at the end of that small grant, I wrote a report with some recommendations and got some really good press on the project, which led to a partnership with the Northeast Document Conservation Center, the NEDCC, in Andover, Massachusetts, which is this really important nonprofit preservation and conservation organization. And together, we created a project to preserve and celebrate HBCU radio, and we got funding from the Mellon Foundation to do it, and the rest is kind of history.
You said you started this in 2017. Have you faced any challenges or obstacles throughout this time? You can just touch on that.
This is a hard one because I have, from almost the get-go, nobody's ever told me no. This has been a truly blessed and truly inspired project because everyone I talk with about it gets excited about it and really does see it, as we in the project see it, as a model for others to follow. So we've been building this framework that any kind of radio station, doesn't have to be an HBCU radio station, doesn't have to be a college radio station, can really embrace and address to preserve the materials that they've produced over the years.
What do you hope will happen with the preserved HBCU radio materials, and why does this preservation matter?
You know, Fran, historical broadcasts are primary sources, and they offer us these little audio snapshots of the past. Radio is a very intimate medium that can transport us back to a moment in time. You close your eyes and listen, and you can be there when you're listening to these historical broadcasts. It's pretty magical. And preserving HBCU radio and making it accessible means researchers, faculty and students, media producers, the general public, everybody has opportunities to time travel through these recordings. But part of the long story is that I quit my day job working as the Title III grant director at an HBCU at Central State University in Wilberforce, Ohio, in 2015. And I went back to school to earn a grad certificate in archives. I learned how vulnerable aging tapes and cassettes are. Old magnetic media is deteriorating even as we're speaking here right now. So I learned how vulnerable the digital files we produce today are too. So I felt like there was some great sense of urgency about preserving the materials themselves and digitizing as much as possible. Some stations don't have much in the way of old materials. A lot of times it gets thrown out, especially when the formats like cassettes become obsolete. There's no longer working equipment for playback. And that's when I realized that we also needed to capture the stories of the stations, their histories, and the impact of their programming on their campuses and communities from the people who actually worked there, who were students or community members and listeners. And that's why the oral history aspect of the project is so important. This history matters. It's our story, and it's also part of the American story.
When you think about how much our history is being erased in many areas, why is this so important to you?
I've been doing preservation work for many years. I really cut my teeth on it back in the late 80s and early 90s working at the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center in Wilberforce, Ohio, when it very first opened in 1988, and became part of the Black museum community and part of the public history community that was really working to preserve African-American history and culture. And this project has been the culmination of all of those years involved in the museum community, also in higher ed, working at at an HBCU working with students. And I see our HBCUs as hallowed ground. They are sacred places. There's an important thing that happens there. It's not just an education. It goes so much further than that. And the radio stations at HBCU campuses are just one of the places where that experience is amplified, where that experience is broadcast, if you will, to not just the campus, but to the community that surrounds that campus. And so engaging in this work has been, you know, it's been a real calling. And I feel like it's something that have been called to do for decades now. And I'm really where I'm supposed to be right now.
Well, we are so grateful that, first of all, that this has been your passion and the keeper of our history and one that preserves our history is so important to all of us. And so we want to thank you for sharing this information with us, and we appreciate you.
Oh, well, really happy to do it. Thanks.
Those insights from Jocelyn Robinson really put into perspective how much history is at stake.
Amazing, amazing. And something that resonated with me was this is sacred ground for HBCUs. I went to Morehouse College and I was in the school newspaper, the Maroon Tiger, and hearing past editors and alum tell me how sacred that is and how important the Maroon Tiger was. I can only imagine for the radio stations at Hampton or Central State or FAMU, different radio stations, how important they are, and really want to celebrate that.
It reminds me of something Dr. Baptiste said earlier about truth being at the core of this work. These archives are historical documentary evidence of how our communities navigate challenging times and build solidarity through the airwaves.
And they represent a remarkable technical and cultural achievement, too. These stations create professional broadcast operations, often with minimal resources in the face of significant obstacles.
As we wrap up today's show, I want to thank our guests and our listeners for joining us for this exploration of HBCU radio history and the vital work of preservation.
And we're just getting started. Next, Broadcasting History, the HBCU Radio Legacy, will spotlight one remarkable institution's journey.
That's right. We'll be taking a deep dive into Elizabeth City State University's radio legacy through WRVS-FM. Since its founding in 1986, WRVS has been a vital communications link for Northeastern North Carolina's rural Black communities, providing crucial information during hurricanes, fostering community dialogue, and preserving regional cultural traditions. I'm really excited about this episode because we'll hear from station founders, current staff, and community members about the station's evolution and impact.
Plus, we'll explore how WRVS has adapted to changing technologies while maintaining its essential community service mission in a region often overlooked by larger media outlets.
That's next time on Broadcasting History, the HBCU Radio Legacy. I'm Fran Robinson.
And I'm Miles.
Thank you for listening.
Broadcasting History, the HBCU Radio Legacy. This episode was produced by Could Be Pretty Cool. Our executive producer is Jocelyn Robinson, director of the Center for Radio Preservation and Archives at WYSO Public Radio in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Broadcasting History, the HBCU Radio Legacy, is a production of the HBCU Radio Preservation Project. For more information, visit our project webpage at wyso.org.